Hello and welcome to Credit Notes, a podcast in partnership with AIG that aims to provide a deeper dive into the world of trade finance and the critical issues impacting global commerce. My name is Sam Lowe. I'm a partner at Flint Global and head of its trade and market access practice. Joining us today for our third episode to discuss the effectiveness of sanctions both now and in the future are Agathe Desmarais, Senior Policy Fellow at the European Council of Foreign Relations and author of the book Backfire, How Sanctions Reshape the World Against US Interests, and Brad Setzer, the Whitney Shepherdson Senior Fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations and former Senior Advisor to the US Trade Representative. Welcome both.
Hello.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. So I thought we'd just get straight into it. But before talking about the sort of effectiveness of sanctions, I thought it might be useful to sort of set a baseline and clarify what we mean. Because obviously sanctions have been around for quite a long time, but there's definitely been a sort of change since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So what is it that has changed? And Agathe, I might start with you and possibly on the good side before moving to Brad on the financial services side, although I know you've both got a lot to say about both.
Thanks so much, Sam. I'm delighted to be a part of the podcast today. So I think a lot has changed, essentially, as you've said. I think that sanctions against Russia were a turning point for sanctions. So, of course, we have trade measures, for instance, the EU ban on seaborne oil imports. We also have financial measures, such as the freeze in Russia's central bank assets. I think that three things stand out to me in terms of why sanctions against Russia were a turning point. I think the first reason why these were a turning point is that it's the first time that G7 allies targeted such a large economy as Russia. Russia's GDP, nominal GDP, was the eighth largest in the world in 2022. So that's obviously huge. It has nothing to do, nothing by comparison to targeting North Korea or even Iran. I think this is a very large economy with a huge global footprint because Russia is such a big exporter of many commodities. We think of oil, we think of gas, but also grains, for instance, or gold. And that, of course, meant that G7 allies had to use some caution, because if you go, for instance, for secondary sanctions, that would have forced all firms around the world to make a choice between doing business with Russia and doing business with the US, then you would have had ripple effects all around the world. And that's why the US has been so cautious, from my perspective, with secondary sanctions on Russia, which only target the Russian military sector for now. The second factor that I think is one of the reasons why such sanctions were a turning point is that G7 allies went for unthinkable measures. Essentially, 3 years ago, I think that someone who would have said that European countries would go for a ban on seaborne Russian oil imports, this person would have been certainly seen as heretical, but it happened. And so I think that there was a degree of innovation and some measures that were unthinkable. We can think of the freeze of the assets, nearly $300 billion in assets from the Russian central bank, the EU G7 oil price cap, setting a price cap of $60 for Russian oil exports if there is involvement of Western firms. I think this was also a very innovative measure. You know, you really had to create it. And as I've mentioned, also the EU ban on seaborne oil imports. I think that this all showed a degree of innovation and unthinkable measures previously. And then finally, well, it may well change because we are recording this podcast on November 6th. So we know now that Trump has been reelected as president, but I think that Russia sanctions also showed a lot of unity, both between EU member states, because the bigger picture is that EU member states remained on board for the sanctions effort. Sanctions have to be renewed at unanimity every 6 months, and still even member states like Hungary continued with the sanctions effort, but also transatlantic collaboration on sanctions. And I'll stop here because I think this is a very good segue for what Brad will have to say on this topic.
Yes, Brad.
Well, also, thank you for inviting me to join you on this podcast. I generally think everything Agathe said is absolutely correct. The uniqueness of the current round of sanctions stems from the fact that they were applied to a much bigger economy than any economy that had previously been subject to this kind of sanctions, and that within the realm of the financial sanctions arsenal, the U.S. and Europe collectively went for some of the strongest measures. Now, there are still ways you could strengthen the sanctions further. but freezing the Central Bank of Russia's reserves was, an unprecedented act. No comparably large pool of reserves had ever been frozen, essentially blocking the two biggest Russian banks, but not the third biggest. You know, Gazprom Bank remains unsanctioned and available for payments from global business. Full blocking sanctions on the two biggest Russian banks, also broadly unprecedented. And then I think finally, the uniqueness around the fact that Russia remains a critical oil exporter, an important supplier even now of LNG to Europe. And it's sort of striking that seaborne oil has been sanctioned, but seaborne LNG has not. All sanctions regimes reflect some compromises and choices. And the U.S. in particular has been very concerned in some sense and constrained in its use of sanctions because it has never wanted to fully block Russian oil from the global market, which I think is a different regime than has been employed in past sanctioning efforts, where there was at least a willingness conceptually to try to take that oil fully off the market. In this case, the U.S. in particular, but I think many European countries as well, wanted the oil to continue to reach the market even if they were not buying it. And I think that created a set, created the compromise, which was the price cap, and has created some complexities in sanctions enforcement.
Thank you. You mentioned sort of in passing the correspondent banking issue and sort of restrictions on two of the three biggest banks accessing, I suppose, US financial markets. I remember at the time when that was announced, that becoming as, quite a surprise in a way, as in it was something that sort of had been pontificated, but actually being enacted was, I suppose, just slightly shocking in the first instance. Sort of, how does that work in practice? Like, what's the sort of thought process behind it? What's the objective?
I think the objective was punitive. The biggest Russian banks were subject to what were thought to be fairly targeted but still effective sanctions after Crimea, after 2014, mm-hmm. 2015, which blocked the banks from accessing new longer-term financing. So they could only get, I think, three-month money from the U.S. and from Europe. The efficacy of a U.S.-only sanction for limiting the financing of the big Russian state banks would have been very modest. And the goal of those sanctions was basically to force Russia to use its reserves to cover the maturing debt of its big state banks and some of its big state companies. The goal of a block, which is what was put in place, is basically to shut down that institution, to make it, force those institutions to disappear, not be available for doing any banking business globally. Sparbank, VTB can still do business in Russia in rubles. Mm-hmm. They can do business in yuan with China, but they couldn't do dollar or euro businesses, and the subsidiaries in Europe had to be wound down. So the goal was to just more or less isolate Russia financially and say one of the costs of invading Ukraine was that your big banks can no longer be global banks. That said, carve-outs were made and Gazprom Bank was excluded from the sanctions so as to allow some space for ongoing payments for oil, gas, metals, food, grain, titanium, uranium, you name it. So it was never a close to a full block, but it wasn't a full block, and it certainly wasn't a full block for all forms of current payment because of a desire for some element of trade to remain.
Yeah, and in the European context, the sort of some element of trade to remain question was always quite sort of, not sure if enjoyable is the correct word, but it was interesting to observe in the context of different member states and their specific interests in relation to, say, luxury goods or the like. So I think that's maybe the one element we haven't mentioned. I suppose it's more traditional in the sanctions sense in just sanctions on the export or import of specific products. But I suppose the other one that I maybe had a question on in terms of comparability with sort of pre-invasion and post is if there were any changes made to the sanctions related to specific individuals, if that they were consistent with what was imposed before, or if there were tweaks made. I'm not sure if either of you sort of have a view on that.
I think a broader set of individuals were fully blocked, fully sanctioned. But I think the basic tool was always a component of the sanctions regime. It was just deployed much more broadly. Maybe there were some more specific changes made to confiscate a broader set of assets. But you know, certainly the targeted sanctions that block or freeze the assets of individuals with a direct nexus to the military activity were a part of the toolkit before. I think that nexus got expanded to hit a broader set of individuals. And so it was not a new tool, but it was a more expansive use of an existing tool. That's my interpretation.
Is that yours too, Agatha?
Yes, definitely. That's definitely my interpretation. But I think it's really useful from that perspective to make a difference between sanctions for symbol and sanctions for impact. And I think that when we take a look at individual measures, that is to say measures that are targeting, say, Russian businessmen that are well connected to the Kremlin or Russian officials, well, individual measures mean that they cannot travel to Europe or to the US. Well, I'm not sure they would have any plans to do so these days. And their assets in the US or in Europe are frozen. But I think that in the grand scheme of things, these sanctions have a very important diplomatic and symbolic value. But the economic sanctions, we were mentioning, for instance, the EU ban on seaborne oil imports. These are the most important sanctions, the sanctions that are meant to degrade Russia's ability to wage war against Ukraine. And I think there's a lot of confusion around the objectives of sanctions. And I know you'll want to talk about that, but yes. I think that this is a really important thing to mention, that the sanctions are meant to degrade Russia's ability to wage war. So it's not really about confiscating the assets of oligarchs. It's not going to change anything in the grand scheme of things. Of course, these individuals are going to hate it, or maybe take it as a badge of honor sometimes. But I think the grand scheme of things, what really matters are measures that are targeting the Russian economy.
So that's a really great segue into the next section where I'm going to ask you about your assessment of effectiveness. And when I was wrestling with this question beforehand, because I sort of understand through having lots of these conversations that when you ask people whether something's been effective, it really does depend on their definition of what the interventions were designed to achieve, or what they hope it would achieve, or what they, in their grand scheme of things, sort of would pray it would achieve. So what I'm going to do here actually is ask you to provide your own definition of effectiveness and then assess against it, because I think it's easier than me pushing my own on you or just assuming everyone shares the same view. So with that large caveat, how effective do you think these sanctions have been? So I might just go in the same order as before.
So I think that's the multi-million dollar question. And certainly in Europe, I'm French, and in France, this is definitely a heated debate. If you're looking for a topic for a family dinner and you want a heated debate, talk about the effectiveness of Russia's sanctions. By all means, it's going to be a massive success. I think that when we try to assess the effectiveness of sanctions, we have to remember that these are a tool. So it depends what you want to do. With a screwdriver, I wouldn't attempt brain surgery. But, you know, if I need to change a light bulb, maybe it's going to work better. So I think it's really important to go back to the objectives of sanctions. I think there were three objectives. The first one was to send a diplomatic signal of resolve and unity to both Russia and Ukraine. And I think from that perspective, I would say mission accomplished. Check. Definitely there was this strong message of unity and resolve. Again, this may well change. Know that Trump is going back to the White House, but at least what happened between February 2022 and now is certainly a message of strong Western unity and resolve. Then the second objective, well, it's all about curbing Russia's ability to wage war, both from the financial and technological perspective. And I think that it's important to acknowledge here what we were discussing earlier. Russia is a big economy. It has access to vast financial reserves. So it's not going to be an on and off switch. You can't just put Russia's financial resources to zero with sanctions. This is not going to work. And what we're seeing is that Russia has these vast financial resources, the sovereign wealth fund, for instance, to also finance its war effort. But when we take a look at the measures, the measures are meant to curb Russia's hydrocarbon revenue. So, you know, I keep mentioning this EU ban on seaborne oil imports, but I think it's a very important measure. And what we're seeing in the data from the Kiev School of Economics is that these measures have led to losses for Russia of about $132 billion since the start of the war. So it's not enough to completely stop Russia's war effort, but it's not nothing. $132 billion is about 8 months of oil export earnings in 2021. So that's definitely significant. And then there's the question of technology access. You know, all the export controls on semiconductors making it more difficult for Russia to access microchips. So again, it's not an on and off switch. There is sanctions evasion, there is circumvention. But these networks mean that it's trickier and it takes more time and it's more expensive for Russia to source these goods. So it's all making it more difficult. And then the third objective from my perspective, well, it dates back to 2014 and the annexation of Crimea and Russia's backing of separatist rebels in eastern Ukraine, in Donbas region. Well, it's all about prompting a slow asphyxiation of the Russian energy sector. We have measures, especially American measures dating back to 2014, that make it very difficult for a Russian energy sector to raise money and to access Western technology. And these are going to bite and really hurt in the long run, which also shows that sanctions are a marathon, not a sprint, because a number of Russian energy fields are coming to what is politely called maturity. Their reserves are being depleted, and Russia will struggle to develop new oil and gas fields. And so when we take a look at the data from the International Energy Agency, nowadays, well, actually in 2022, 30% of globally traded oil and gas was from Russian origin, but the IEA believes that this share is going to fall to 15% in 2030, which is essentially tomorrow.
Thank you. And Brad, same question to you. And again, please provide your own definition of effectiveness, which you can assess against, because, yeah, I think that's probably the best way of doing this.
Look, I unsurprisingly largely agree with the definitions that Agatha put forward. And I broadly agree with her assessment of the effectiveness of those measures on those specific scales. There is a further definition of effectiveness, which is the one that sometimes is put forward and is probably an unrealistic goal, was to change Putin's calculus about whether to continue to wage the war. And on that broad metric, the sanctions have failed unambiguously. They have not inflicted such damage on Russia's economy that it has led to a shift in Putin's own assessment of Russia's broader interest. On a technical level, the sanctions have really generally worked pretty well. And the freeze of central bank reserves has been a complete freeze. And now those revenues are going to Ukraine. That is about as good a technical outcome as you could realistically expect. I don't think there's much evidence that VTB and Sberbank continue to operate as major global banks. They were effectively frozen out of the global market. And those banks that were not sanctioned continue to function and function as a conduit for payments for those goods that the U.S. and Europe still want to import and export to Russia. I think the price cap, which was one of the more innovative sanctions, I mean, its goal was obvious. It was to limit Russia's oil revenue. And it was broadly effective at adding to the frictional costs associated with Russian oil exports in a way that both meant Russian oil was still flowing to the global market and that Russian oil was selling at a discount. Now, you could have probably achieved that more efficiently with a different subset of measures. A tax on imports into Europe, for example, might have achieved that goal more directly. But it, broadly speaking, did introduce the discount on Russian crude, which reduced Russia's revenues. But it didn't do so in a way that reduced Russia's revenues to the level where Russia's ability to continue to wage war was impeded. Nor did it keep Russian oil off the market in a way that generated a permanent shock to the American and European economies. It was not a measure designed to do to produce a shock like the cutoff of pipeline gas it had. It was designed to just kind of set a new regime for the export of Russian oil, where Russian oil hit the market at a lower price point. Over time, it has lost some of its impact because, unsurprisingly, tankers, the sanction was on seaborne shipment, not on payment. So that was a choice. And because it was a sanction on seaborne shipment, it relied on Russia's need for insurance, Russia not owning all the tankers it needed to carry its oil longer distances, so forth and so on. And quite reasonably, trade has migrated to a new set of tankers, which are used tankers that various entities involved in the oil trade have bought. And increasingly, insurance is provided by the importer or by Russia directly, not through the London or European maritime shipping market. I think these were expected, but it signals that sanctions, when you have a targeted sanction that is designed to limit its impact on your own economy, you tend to open up opportunities for the sanctioned party to minimize its impact over time. And I think that's what we see.
Agatha.
Yeah, I wanted to react on this one because I completely agree with Brad. And I think part of the confusion around the effectiveness of sanctions, or alleged ineffectiveness of sanctions, according to some people, and especially according to the Kremlin, is that this narrative eclipses the fact that sanctions target will always adapt. As Brad said, it is completely unsurprising that Russia would assemble a shadow fleet of oil tankers to export its oil despite the oil price cap. And I think that part of the confusion on this sanctions effectiveness question is not acknowledging that adaptation will always happen. So some measures will only be effective in the short term or in the medium term. In the long run, you have to adapt. It's a game of cat and mouse between the sender of sanctions and the target of sanctions. But it will always happen, such sanctions adaptation. And so I thought the point from Brad was really, really an important one.
Because this question about adaptation is one that I spend quite a lot of time thinking about, because I sometimes have some, if I'm honest, some frustration with the charts you see popping up on social media, where you will see someone will, as evidence of sanctions ineffectiveness, they will post a chart that shows that German exports of sanctioned product to Turkey have risen by $20 million since the imposition of the sanctions, or German exports to Uzbekistan have risen by $30 million. And to my mind, that's evidence of something, but it's not necessarily evidence of sanctions ineffectiveness, or it could be. And I'm, please disagree with me on this, and because sometimes I look at that and say, well, actually, that's not very much money. So you need to look at the cumulative impact. And also, there might be some other reasons why the trade data before showed something differently. But also, I mean, my question is, what is it? As in, if it's some cars, I'm less bothered than if it's something that's going to be used on the battlefield. But it does mean that I sometimes find it quite hard to assess effectiveness, because I've sort of just thrown lots of different information and I'm not always quite sure what to make about it. So your articulation of the issue right now has been incredibly helpful from that perspective. But on the trade side, is Russia getting the stuff it needs to wage war? I suppose it's a very crude judgment of effectiveness. What's your view? Has it worked out how to get all the things it needs, or hasn't it?
Well, I think that's a very important question. And I think that oftentimes the answer to this question is painted in black and white terms. So you would have this narrative, export controls do not work because there is sanctions evasion. No, sanctions evasion is always going to happen. In 1806, Napoleon imposed a trade embargo against Great Britain. Great Britain devised smuggling routes to try to circumvent it. So I think that sanctions evasion is a given. It's going to happen, and we'll have adaptation to the target, as we've just discussed. To answer your question, I think it's useful to take a look at the big picture. What we know is for 2023, so not taking a look at, I don't know, weekly data or monthly data, and there's also the question of the reliability of data, Russia's imports of high-tech goods have dropped by around 30% in 2023 compared to 2021. So, of course, that's not enough to stop the Russian war effort, but that's not nothing. And then there's the question of the price of these Russian imports. When we take a look at the data again, so say take a look at Turkey's customs data, we see that the median price of Turkish exports to Russia has increased by 80% in the first half of 2023, compared to a 19% rise in Turkish shipments to other countries. So what this suggests, at least to me, is that Moscow is paying much more to access some dual-use goods through circumvention networks. And then you were mentioning, the sky-high growth rates of trade for trade between the EU and some Central Asian countries. So we see, for instance, that Germany's exports to Kyrgyzstan rose 13-fold between 2021 and 2023, but they still amount to only $800 million per year. So that's nothing. By comparison, Russian imports of high-tech goods stood at $34 billion in 2021. So I think it's useful not to take a look at things in growth rate terms from a low base, but in value terms. And so in the grand scheme of things, I'm not entirely sure that such schemes make a massive difference to the Russian war effort. It doesn't mean we shouldn't tackle sanctions or convention, but I think in the grand scheme of things, it's important to get some perspective on the topic.
Look, I think there's a component of the rerouting of trade. And I'd have to go and look at what was a controlled good versus what subset of goods were just a victim of a tariff war between Russia and Europe, which had the predictable results of all tariff wars, which are between bilateral partners, where you incentivize trade through third parties. I don't think there's actually any technical sanctions avoidance because the sanctions were not written in such a way. If you ship a Mercedes to a dealer in Kazakhstan and a Russian drives across the border and buys that Mercedes from a Kazakh dealer rather than from a dealer in Russia, that was never a prohibited good. And in some deep conceptual sense, if you were not willing to stop trade with China in these goods, there was no way you were going to fully stop trade with Russia because any good that goes to China, given China's views on the invasion and China's tacit support for Russia, would ultimately be available to Russia. And I think that is a more general point about a lot of the sanctions that were designed to impact the Russian war effort. They did have an impact. They forced Russia into China's arms, but China is actually a very effective supplier of most goods that an energy exporting economy needs. And so you maybe degraded the efficiency of certain high-tech Russian weapons, but you haven't prevented Russia, which itself had a big basic ammunitions industry, from getting access to whatever chemicals it needs to conduct and build basic military equipment, nor have you precluded Russia from accessing and Russians from accessing the basic consumer goods of a modern economy, because so much of that can be supplied by China. So we're in a world of significant sanctions. But we're not in a world of full sanctions. And we're in a world of significant impediments to trade, but not of full impediments to trade. In some sense, the trade through Kyrgyzstan is the analog of Russian oil exports going to India and being refined, and then the refined product being shipped back to Europe. It's added frictions, which is a typical result, without fully blocking trade. But in order to fully block trade, you almost have to stop exporting to a much broader set of countries, and that was never contemplated. We've been in a big sanctions war, but not a full sanctions war.
That's hugely helpful, helping me refine my understanding and assessment of the impact and effectiveness of sanctions so far, which also moves me on, I suppose, to the final part of this discussion, which we've sort of been building up to deliberately, in a sense, which is how replicable are these measures in the context of a larger economy? There's one obvious candidate, but I suppose hypothetically it could be in the context of others. And I suppose in that context, are there idiosyncrasies of the Russian economy that make the recent round specifically particularly effective or ineffective? And of the recent round of measures, which do you think are the most replicable, or are there some measures which you just don't think would be appropriate in a different scenario? I might start with Brad this time.
So I actually think almost all of the financial sanctions are applicable for even bigger economies. So obviously China. I think in the event, and one would not want this event to happen, that China puts a blockade around Taiwan or China moves militarily across the Taiwan Straits, and a relatively straightforward response would be a financial blockade that limits China's access to the external assets of the central bank. So replicating the freeze on the Central Bank of Russia's reserves. The Fed, the ECB would have to stand ready to minimize the impact of that on their respective bond markets. But I think we've seen that they can do that. That's what they did at the start of COVID. And then I think you could actually freeze the assets of the big Chinese state banks in a relatively replicable way. Of course, those assets are, you know, the big dollar balance sheet of the Chinese state banks provide credit to other parts of the global economy. So you would have to be ready to replicate that flow of credit. But I think those measures are actually pretty replicable. The part that's much harder, and that's also the most important difference, is kind of obvious. Russia is an exporter of oil and an exporter of minerals, metals, and food to a more modest extent. China is an importer of commodities, an importer of metals, particularly iron. And I think the key question is, would you try to limit China's ability to import oil and metals by constraining China's ability to use the global financial system to buy those goods, which, you know, China has alternative mechanisms of payment. It may or may not work. But the impact of denying China the ability to buy oil is actually a positive shock to other oil consumers. So you don't have the precise same dynamics. Conversely, you have to worry much more about the flow of Chinese components out of China and think about whether you want to decouple forcibly or whether you think decoupling forcibly would be too big of a shock to your own economy and you want that aspect of trade to continue. And in the short run, there are an awful lot of Chinese components that matter and it might be hard to cut off. And then, well, okay, you cut off direct trade. What about indirect trade through Southeast Asia? Do all those components come to you indirectly? You cut off direct payments, you can still pay, a company in Thailand, which then goes and buys certain components from China. And it becomes the opposite question around Chinese sanctions enforcement. Are the Chinese going to really crack down on the flow of critical manufacturing inputs to the rest of the global economy? So I think a lot of the measures carry over. They are more consequential for China, because China is a bigger economy. Its banks, state banks are much bigger. Its foreign reserve holdings are much, much bigger. But you could, in my view, in the extreme case of a true crisis around Taiwan, replicate a lot of the financial sanctions. And then I think you just have to flip and invert some of the other sanctions because you would want China to pay more for its oil imports. You would want China to have to pay more for its imports of iron ore if you're going to allow any iron in, because you might want to shut down China's steel industry. You're going to want to make sure, at least for those components that you can't easily replicate, that Chinese goods still flow to your markets. So it's a inverted relationship, in my view.
So I think to answer this question is having a look at the lessons from Ukraine-related sanctions. So the one thing that I would say first is that for sanctions, there is no one-size-fits-all. And I think it's super important to take a look at the sanctions target, at the objectives, at the coalition, at the pain points also of the target, you know, hydrocarbon export revenues. That's definitely a potential pain point for Russia, but it could be very different for China, as Brad says. To me, there are three lessons that I think we can learn from Ukraine-related sanctions. The first one is about sanctions deterrence. And I think that from that perspective, sanctions deterrence failed in the case of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But there is a caveat to this analysis, and it is that initial sanctions threats from both the US and Europe were powerful on paper. You know, it was really bold measures at the time. But in the end, the measures that were eventually imposed were far stronger and bolder and tougher than those that had been part of initial sanctions deterrence packages. So I think there is a lesson here, because it defeats the point of deterrence to threaten sanctions, but in the end to go for something even more powerful than was initially threatened. To me, the second lesson is about sanctions inoculation. So what is inoculation? Well, essentially, it's inserting a small, harmless quantity of a disease into a human body. In 1796, British scientist Edward Jenner inoculated cowpox into a child. And cowpox is usually mild, but actually that rendered the child immune to much deadlier smallpox that gave him long-term immunity to a much deadlier disease. And I think that we've been doing sanctions inoculation with Russia when we go for mild sanctions. For instance, disconnecting only 7 Russian banks from SWIFT. I think that what it did is send a signal to Russia that maybe a full disconnection from SWIFT was a possibility. And so Russian banks have been trying to connect to the Chinese alternative to SWIFT called SIPS in droves. We're seeing that the number of Russian banks connected to SIPS has really increased. So I think that we need to be careful about this one. And then finally, there's the question of sanctions vaccination, another medical analogy. What is sanctions vaccination? Well, we're seeing China, Russia, Iran, Venezuela, well, all the members of the International Coalition of the Rogues try to vaccinate themselves preemptively against sanctions. And this rests on de-dollarization. We're seeing that Russia uses Western currencies only for 20% of its cross-border trade these days. So that definitely adds a layer of protection. Connecting to alternatives to SWIFT, also doubling down on central bank digital currencies. I think that this is all going to mean that in the long run, given China is really doubling down on such efforts, that will make financial sanctions less effective against China, because we're really talking about China and a Taiwan conflict scenario here. What I do think will remain useful is replicating sanctions targeting Russia's access to the European market. I think that this is the flow or the Achilles heel for a Chinese economy. China needs to export. When we take a look at China's exports to G7 countries, these are critical for a Chinese economy. So that's probably the G7 leverage measures restricting Chinese exports to G7 countries. Of course, not every export, because that would be devastating for G7 economies, but of some non-critical consumer goods that could still deal a blow to the Chinese economy. So I think that this is something probably to keep in mind, replicating measures targeting Russia's access to the European energy market.
Thank you. It's quite an interesting conceptual point, this idea that because of the nature of, in this instance, the Chinese economy and the fact it's essentially much more integrated and much more advanced, at least in terms of its export profile and the like, that thinking about what comes out of it and our response to that becomes much more important than thinking about what we're sending in. When you start thinking about the different design of these approaches and the implications, I think it's quite wide ranging. I'm not going to attempt to summarize what you've both said, because my view on this is that the summaries are often much worse than what was previously said and repetitive, and people have already just heard it from the horse's mouth. But I am just going to ask, just before we finish, just if there's anything else that we sort of missed in this discussion that you think is important?
I guess I'll make a follow-on point to the vaccination point, which is that if countries try to inoculate or vaccinate against the impact of sanctions, and I think you can certainly argue that one effect of the 2014-2015 sanctions on Russia and on the Russian banks was it helped inoculate them to some degree from the more draconian measures taken later. They also, to some degree, helped inoculate the European banking system and other banking systems from the impact of those sanctions. But sanctions are like viruses. They evolve. And as they evolve, sometimes they find ways around the previous sets of vaccinations. And so it is an evolutionary arms race for microbiology. And I think there's also a little bit of an evolutionary arms race in sanctions and sanctions enforcement. And I guess to me, it's interesting, though, that after the very strong initial steps taken against Russia, broadly speaking, hasn't been a huge effort to strengthen and expand those sanctions. That doesn't mean they continue to have an impact. They continue to reduce the amount of revenue that Russia gets, but there's not really been an effort to sort of ratchet up another step. Let's take Russian goods off the global market. And so at least I think it is possible in a scenario around Taiwan that, at least from the U.S. side, that becomes such a critical national interest that the U.S. will be willing to do round one of very heavy sanctions and would be willing to do round two, which might be even broader and tougher and involve much more secondary sanctions, because it would be, an alternative to direct shooting wars. And in that context, you may be willing to go even further. And I think it is also the case that when thinking about contingencies around Taiwan, there's probably a bigger set of actions that the U.S. could do on its own than what the U.S. could do on its own vis-a-vis Russia. China has many more dollar assets than Russia does and fewer alternatives for hiding them. But it is also the case that the efficacy of most sanctions is increased if it is all members of the G7, all members of the G10. And I do think that any contingency around Taiwan, the question of the unity of a sanctioning coalition and how far the U.S. lets the need for unity amongst the coalition, which enhances effectiveness, constrain the U.S. from ratcheting up the sanctions to the highest possible level. I think that's going to be an interesting debate. Should we be in that difficult, unfortunate scenario?
Actually, that's a perfect segue to a comment that I wanted to make on the Taiwan scenario seen from a European perspective. So I've recently published a policy brief with ECFR on this topic. And I think that what was striking as I was researching this issue of EU and G7 sanctions options for a Taiwan conflict scenarios is, in Europe, very few policymakers want to hear about such a scenario. And I think this is in stark contrast with the American discussion. Certainly when I go to Washington, in Washington, the Taiwan contingency scenarios are discussed quite a bit. And I think that one reaction that I've often heard in Europe about such a scenario is essentially, oh, but Europe would never go for sanctions against China in such a scenario. And I think that as my final remark, I would push back against that point, because in a real conflict scenario around Taiwan with potentially some US military response, I think it would be very difficult for Europe to tell Washington, sorry, not our war, we're not going to be doing anything. And I think that this is an important thing to understand in Europe, especially with Trump back at the White House. So definitely the Taiwan scenarios are sometimes seen as not a European problem, but I think it would definitely be also a big question for Europeans in such a contingency scenario.
I think that's a very good concluding comment. I'd like to thank you both for your time and for the enlightening discussion. I didn't think we'd spend so much time discussing the intricacies of vaccines and medicines, but I'm glad we did, because it's actually a very helpful analogy in this context. And with that, I'd like to thank all the listeners for listening to Credit Notes in partnership with AIG, and goodbye from me, Sam Lowe.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast series are those of the speakers and do not reflect the views, policy, or position of American International Group, Inc., or its subsidiaries or affiliates, AIG. Any content provided by the speakers in this podcast series is their opinion and is not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, individual, or group of individuals, or anyone or anything. AIG makes no warranty or representations as to the accuracy, completeness, correctness, or validity of any information provided during this podcast series, and AIG will not be liable for any errors, inaccuracies, or omissions in the information provided during this podcast series, or any damages, losses, liabilities, injuries resulting from or arising from the podcast, including your use of the podcast.